Welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today is to give you that shortcut to being truly well-informed. We're synthesizing three massive and honestly highly volatile source areas. We've got the financial anxieties gripping portfolio managers, the policy fallout in Washington after that dramatic government reopening, and then a fascinating look at these deep cultural fault lines splitting conservative women.
And it's an absolutely necessary synthesis because all these sources, they're pointing toward a singular observation.
Right.
We are living in a moment that is just defined by profound systemic uncertainty. Investors are worried, policymakers are showing, record levels of dysfunction.
And the rhetoric is
It's
dire.
approaching historical extremes. We're dealing with what one of our sources called a persistent wall of worry.
The wall of worry. I like
Right.
that. So, okay, we're going to start by looking for those financial cockroaches, the hidden weaknesses in the market.
Yes.
Then we'll navigate the chaos following the government's reopening. And that includes a serious look at why the economic data we're getting right now is, well, suspect.
To say the least.
And finally, we'll explore that really surprising ideological split among influential conservative women who are publicly debating what it even means to be a Republican in 2025. Okay, let's unpack this. So, when you talk to advisors, to portfolio managers right now, particularly in fixed income, the number one anxiety seems to be credit quality.
It is.
We just saw this notable shakeout, these surprise bankruptcies in the auto sector. For someone who's not in finance day to day, what exactly led to that sudden weakness being exposed?
Well, what happened was really a classic example of market demand overriding diligence. I mean, the demand for yield has been so strong that risks were frankly just overlooked.
Okay.
But when these auto companies had to go back to the market to refinance their debt, analysts finally had to, look at the
They
paperwork.
had to do the homework.
They had to do the homework. And they realized the underlying credit quality was just terrible. So the surprise wasn't that they were bad credits. The surprise was that the market had tolerated them for so long.
And that brings us to that infamous cockroach theory comment from Jamie Dimon. What does that theory imply for the market right now?
The theory is, it's simple, but it's terrifying if you're a risk manager.
Right.
If you find one cockroach, one surprise bankruptcy, it suggests that there are probably more bad credits hiding in the woodwork, ones that haven't been uncovered yet because liquidity has been so high.
Right.
So this intensive search for where the next unexpected default is lurking, that's dominating credit right now.
So that's the micro anxiety. But if we pull back, the macro concern that seems to have everyone talking is debt deficits and, of course, the risk of an AI bubble.
Yeah.
Is this just cyclical nervousness, or is there something different about AI financing?
It's both. The AI concern isn't just about valuation, which is, very high. It's specifically about whether there is circular financing fueling it.
Circular financing. So a self-feeding loop where the paper value just reinforces more paper value?
Exactly. The company is, in essence, generating the appearance of growth by borrowing money, often against their inflated stock, and then using that money to buy other companies in the same ecosystem.
Wow.
And if one major player disappoints, that shock could ripple through the entire interconnected sector very, very quickly. That's the landmine investors are worried about.
And what about the debt problem?
Well, separately, you have to mention it, the U.S. deficit to GDP is running close to 7% this year. And the market is concerned because there is, zero political discipline in Washington to curb it.
Which complicates the Fed's job.
Fundamentally, it complicates managing inflation and maintaining confidence in longer-term bonds.
It's interesting, the sources noted this overall investor sentiment is just so pessimistic. But the old adage says that might actually be a good sign. The market likes to climb a wall of worry. Maybe that worry is the fuel. Okay, moving to policy. Let's tackle the government reopening. After more than 40 days, it's resolved with a temporary continuing resolution, a CR. Funding is extended through January 30th, 2026. What was actually accomplished here?
Well, the CR mostly just bought time, but crucially, they did manage to pass three of the 12 underlying appropriations bills.
Okay, which ones?
Agriculture, which is vital because it fully funds SNAP food stamps for about 42 million low-income Americans. They also passed military construction veterans and the legislative branch bill.
And what about for the federal workers?
That was essential. Back pay was ensured, and the roughly 4,100 workers who'd been fired during the shutdown were reinstated.
But in a bill that's supposed to be just about keeping the lights on and funding food stamps, they slipped in this highly specific, very targeted legal provision about the January 6th investigation.
They did. It really puts a fine point on Congress's priorities right now.
I'll say.
there is a provision allowing members of Congress to retroactively sue the government for up to $500,000 if their personal phone data was accessed without consent during that investigation.
Wow. Just wow. Okay, but the most critical failure in this process had to be not extending the Affordable Care Act subsidies. What are the concrete implications of that?
The consequences are immediate and quite severe for millions. These subsidies, they were put in place during COVID, and they were set to expire at the end of 2025.
Right.
Because the funding wasn't extended, an estimated 22 million Americans who bought insurance through the ACA are now facing premium hikes for 2026.
And this caused a huge rift in the Democratic Party.
A huge rift. Republicans successfully insisted it be a separate discussion. Now, Democrats got an agreement for a Senate vote before mid-December, but there's no guarantee it passes or that the House even takes it up.
And beyond all the political wrangling, there's a serious technical problem now, isn't there? The shutdown affected the release of key federal data, jobs reports, inflation. How confident can the Fed be in this data?
That is the critical issue for their December meeting. When the government shut down, federal agencies simply stopped collecting the primary data.
They just stopped.
They just stopped. So, for example, the jobs report surveys for October weren't fully conducted. This means a lot of the initial reports we're seeing now rely on, you know, patchwork data, estimates, partial information.
So we're dealing with a distorted view of the economy.
Exactly. The general expectation among analysts is that confidence in truly accurate, clean data won't return until the end of the year, maybe even early January 2026.
Which puts the Fed in a very odd position, as one source put it.
A very odd position for making rate decisions next month.
And that lack of stability isn't limited to economic data. Let's pivot to the political chaos on Capitol Hill. We've reached a point where censure wars are eating up hours of floor time. One representative said, "The only thing we can apparently do is condemn each other."
It's truly remarkable. Censure, which is just a formal public rebuke, has become common currency. It's used less as a moral tool and more as a, you know, political rallying cry and a fundraising boon.
But there's a potential legislative response to this, right? The Bacon and Byer proposal.
Yes, there is a bipartisan acknowledgement that this is corrosive. Their bill would require a 60% supermajority, not a simple majority, to approve a censure.
The idea being to raise the political cost.
Exactly. Force broad consensus before leadership can just weaponize these votes. And House leaders have said they're open to discussing it, which shows you how out of hand things have gotten.
And if that wasn't extreme enough, we have to talk about the rhetoric coming from the executive branch.
The language is approaching unprecedented highs. The sources report the president suggested that six Democratic lawmakers should be subject to death for seditious behavior.
For what?
After they shared a video encouraging military members to disobey what they deemed unlawful orders.
And the response from House leadership was what? First defensiveness and then a quiet?
A quiet concession that the words were inappropriate.
Yeah, that's right.
The fact that such extreme language, I mean, a threat of execution against sitting members of Congress, is being normalized. It speaks volumes.
Okay, let's shift to a longer-term policy paradox. Investors care deeply about debt, but Congress isn't focused on it. Why the disconnect? The debt is $38 trillion.
The problem is that $38 trillion is, in the words of one source, a nonsense number to most people.
It's too big to comprehend.
Exactly. The average constituent doesn't understand how it affects their daily life. Mm. They don't grasp how rapidly growing interest payments are, diverting funds from, say, infrastructure or social programs.
So if the voters don't apply the pressure, what is the only thing that works?
The bond market, period. Analysts point to past volatility, like the quick turnaround on tariffs last April, as evidence that when the bond market signals distress, Congress has to pay attention.
And yet, earlier this year, they passed the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which included a staggering $5 trillion increase to the debt ceiling.
They did. And that bill was notable because it included specific sweeteners to make it politically palatable.
Right, even for Republicans who'd sworn off increases.
Yes. Four popular tax proposals, retroactive to 2025, no tax on tip income, no tax on overtime, an auto loan interest deduction, and a $6,000 deduction for seniors.
And the political genius, or maybe cynicism, is that they all sunset in 2028.
A presidential election year.
Of course.
Which means their extension is highly probable, regardless of who's in power.
Yeah.
It basically guarantees the debt gets kicked down the road.
Briefly, before we move on, what about the Supreme Court case on tariffs?
It focuses on the mechanism, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEPA. The case questions whether the administration abused that power.
And what's the risk?
A loss is possible. Observers noted a lot of skepticism from the justices during oral arguments. If they lose, it could trigger over $100 billion in refunds to businesses.
$100 billion.
Though the court could sidestep that by making the ruling prospective only, we probably won't see a decision until late 2025 or early 2026.
And let's just finish policy with a quick flame out. The 50-year mortgage idea?
Right. The head of the FHFA floated this. The president publicized it, and it was immediately panned just across the political spectrum.
Because the economics just don't work.
They don't. Slower equity, way more interest paid over a lifetime. The president quickly distanced himself from it, which just reflects the, you know, freewheeling nature of this administration.
Okay, now we pivot to a really deep and I think unexpected cultural fault line playing out on social media. It's this ideological clash among conservative women, basically dividing the MAGA movement.
It is.
The city Republicans versus the trad wives.
This is a fundamental battle over identity and gender roles within conservatism.
Yeah.
On one side, you have the city Republican types, like Raquel DeBono.
Yeah.
She's irreverent, socially libertarian, focused on economic freedom. She calls herself a Sex and the City conservative.
Her whole goal is to prove you can be a conservative woman and still, as she says, have a job and a martini.
Yes, and she's very critical of established groups like Turning Point USA, calling them creepy and culty.
And on the other side.
See, the trad wife movement, with people like Alex Clark, they advocate for biblical womanhood.
So that's much more restrictive. Traditional marriage, submission, pro-Christianity, pro-life.
Absolutely. They oppose things like IVF because of the disposal of embryos. And then you have the ultra-trads like Savannah Stone, who've suggested the 19th Amendment women's suffrage should be revoked.
Revoked. Oh. Wow. So what's the political liability here? Why should Republican strategists be worried about this infighting?
Well, influencers like Emily Wilson argue this focus on restrictive gender roles is a massive political liability. She says, and I'm quoting, "We're going to lose elections if we don't agree to go to the middle ground."
And the infighting gets so petty, right? Like the feud over the engagement rings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A Catholic commentator, Sarah Stock, posted her engagement ring, and Emily Wilson mocked the size. The response from Stock's allies was just vicious, calling Wilson a disgusting feminist whore.
Which just confirms the worst biases of the opposition.
It totally undermines any coherent message to persuadable women voters.
And that raises a critical question about the fragility of this whole coalition. Will this uneasy mix of, you know, conservatism and coarseness just fall apart when the uniting figure is no longer central to the conversation? Let's shift completely to a forward-looking defensive asset, gold. James Rickards gives 8 reasons why gold is the ultimate everything hedge. What are the strongest institutional arguments for its strength?
What's fascinating is the institutional activity. Central banks flipped from being net sellers to net buyers back in 2010.
Right.
And we're seeing the strongest accumulation trend since the late 1960s. That sustained buying, it creates a soft floor under the price.
And supply is constrained.
It's flatlined. Global mine supply has been near 3,500 tons for a decade. Extraction costs are up. Or grades are down, so high demand, flat supply. That's a classic setup.
And what's the best macro environment for gold to rip, as they say?
That would be Quad 4. So that's slowing economic growth and falling inflation. In that specific setup, falling 10-year real yields are a very reliable catalyst for gold prices to rally.
You also have the BRICS countries building their own gold-based system.
Right. They're quietly building a parallel financial framework to the dollar to enhance their own financial independence and trade resilience.
I think the systemic view is the most compelling. Rickards argues gold doesn't go up, fiat currency goes down relative to gold.
Absolutely. Just look at 1971 to 1980. Gold rose 2,300%. If you flip that, it's an implied 95% decline in the dollar's value measured in gold.
And there's a psychological factor, this logarithmic acceleration.
Yes, because people think in these round $1,000 price chunks, the higher gold goes, the psychologically easier the next $1,000 leg becomes. It just fuels accelerating demand.
And finally, the ultimate argument, technological tail risk. Gold is a hedge against, well, digital collapse.
Right. We saw the Cloudflare error take down sites like X and ChatGPT. But the CrowdStrike security update crash was arguably more terrifying.
Catastrophic.
It was. It crashed 8.5 million Windows devices. It locked millions of people out of their bank accounts and revealed this terrifying reality that the modern internet runs on an oligopoly.
Just three cloud providers controlling everything.
63% of the infrastructure. A single fault in a single provider can trigger a global cascade failure. Gold is the ultimate hedge against that specific kind of systemic technological collapse.
We have covered a massive landscape today. From financial worries and the search for credit cockroaches, to intense political volatility, the schisms in the conservative movement, and finally, the ultimate safety net of gold.
It's a moment of just intense complexity. We're seeing record debt, $38 trillion, alongside record political dysfunction, censure wars, execution threats, all while a major cultural coalition faces a deep identity crisis.
So here's a final provocative thought for you to mull over. We know government shutdowns are predictable failures. The party that shuts it down is historically 0 for 8. We also know there are basically no political consequences for congressional leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So what level of internal political breakdown would it actually take for the bond market, the only effective source of pressure we identified, to truly step in and force fiscal change? We'll leave that with you.